paper.
Welcome to episode 44 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Melanie Bronner, an artist in the Pacific Northwest who makes lovely hand-dipped paper and metal jewelry. She grew up around artists, makers, and craftspeople, and never questioned whether she could be making a living as an artist. She learned to make paper with me at the Oregon College of Art and Craft, where she studied book arts and took lots of classes in metals. We talk about how her business took off after she started wearing her jewelry around campus. People were buying the pieces she was wearing, and how she's built a super successful jewelry business with her work in over 50 retail shops around the country today. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Melanie Bronner, welcome to Paper Talk.
Hey, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, Helen. It's really nice to hear your voice again after all this time.
I know. I left Portland in 2012, so I haven't seen you in probably, 7 years.
Yeah, and you moved away while I was still in school, so I'm still not over it.
Yeah. Right. So we'll get to that, but let's start at the beginning. So tell me where you grew up and how art was a part of your life. I'm guessing it might have been.
Yeah, I definitely was. Like, I grew up kind of all over the place. I never know what to say when people ask me where I'm from, because I'm from a lot of places.
Okay.
I lived in Oregon for a long time. We moved to Idaho for a while. We moved to Kentucky for a while. We moved back to Oregon. I moved to Michigan. I moved back to Oregon. So I've kind of lived all over the place, and I feel like my hometown is in a lot of places. Like, I feel like an Oregon, Pacific Northwest girl, but I also feel like kind of a Southern girl in some ways.
Uh-huh.
I spent so much time there.
Right.
So, but my upbringing definitely involved a lot of art making. Both of my grandfathers were artists. My grandfather on my dad's side was a painter.
Okay.
And my grandfather on my mom's side was a fiddler. So I started playing fiddle when I was 6 years old, and that was a huge part of that. Still is a huge part of my life.
Right.
And at one point, I actually thought I was going to be a full time musician. And occasionally, I still look back and go, "Well, maybe I should have." And I still play gigs sometimes, and it's still a big piece of my life. But yeah, I definitely grew up making things a lot. My parents were really, really makers, really craft makers. My dad had a huge wood shop and cabinet shop. My mom was always sewing and making quilts and clothes, and we gardened all the time and preserved food, and so we were always doing things and making things.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that's kind of why I ended up where I am today.
Mm-hmm.
Still making things.
Right. And were you homeschooled?
I started homeschooling when I was in seventh grade.
Okay.
We were living in Kentucky at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the schools were not the best there.
Uh-huh.
So we decided to pull me out. Okay. I wouldn't recommend homeschooling to people.
Uh-huh.
I feel like, I mean, what I can say though is that what I lacked in science and math and some things I maybe would have had to take, I definitely made up for in the arts. So mm-hmm. in a way I have to be grateful to that, because now, you know, here I am making my living in the arts, and maybe that wouldn't have happened, you know, if I hadn't had full immersion starting at like 12 years old.
So what do you mean by full immersion? That's just what you did for?
Yeah, that's all I wanted to do. You know, my mom tried for a little while to do homeschooling curriculum with me, and she did textbooks and grading and all that. And I, at some point, just said, here's how I want to spend my day. I want to play the piano and my fiddle for about 6 hours a day. I want to read novels. Mm-hmm. I want to make paintings and little sculptures. And that's what I did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, for pretty much like all the way up till I started going to college. That's kind of what I did.
Right, right. So I was reading an article about you, and I think, so book arts was the first thing that you started. Weren't you doing some book arts before you went to college? And that's kind of...
Yeah, so I was doing restoration before that, book and paper restoration before that. So I did an apprenticeship at the Valley Library at OSU in Corvallis.
Okay.
And learned bookbinding, archival box making, some basic restoration, and then I did a ton of research on my own. Trial and error and a lot of error.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran a business for about 6 years doing book restoration, but I was kind of got to the point where I felt like I wasn't making anything creative.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big problem for me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I started at OCAC.
Okay, so that's Oregon College of Art and Craft in Portland.
Yeah.
And tell me about your experience there then.
Yeah, I started there in my sort of mid-20s. I already knew what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do a book arts program. Mm-hmm. So I started there. But during my tour of the school, we walked through the whole campus. And very excited about everything to do with book arts. But then we also walked through the metal studio. And I was just blown away. Like that, I decided that was also what I wanted to do with my life. Mm-hmm. So while I was there, I ended up taking a ton of metals classes. So if they'd had a major and a minor, I would have been a metals minor. Mm-hmm. Getting close to a double major, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So you did concentrate in book arts then?
I did, yeah. And I took every book arts, printmaking, paper making, everything there was to take. And jobs beyond as well. Everything, I absorbed everything I possibly could.
Right, and then that's where we met, because you took a class with me in
paper. I did. Yeah, yours was my first exposure to papermaking ever. Uh-huh. And I hadn't even really thought about it that much before, aside from the work I'd done with paper, restoring it, but I never thought about papermaking in terms of art before that. Mm-hmm. But the bug really bit me really hard in your class. Mm-hmm. And I remember the very last day of your class, I came over to you and I asked if I could intern with you. Mm-hmm. And that's how all that got started.
Right. I can't remember which was first. That's right.
Yeah. So then I spent the summer after that, because I took a spring semester with you. And I spent the summer after that, and then off and on for, gosh, a bunch of years after that. I worked for you off and on.
Yeah, you helped with a bunch of projects. And actually, I'm going to insert a little bit about my internship program right now, because sometimes people seem surprised. They don't know. So there is something about it on my website. It's very brief. And but I had a lot of interns in Portland in particular.
Yeah.
Since I've moved to Colorado, I don't have as many. It's harder to find a place to stay. You have to have a car where I live.
Oh, I see.
It's a remote location to fly into. So anyways, but I have an intern coming for a couple weeks this summer, and I still have interns from time to time.
I love doing it. It was wonderful. Yeah. And that's same time I started interning for you. I also started interning for Barb Tettenbaum and doing a lot of work for her. And then I ended up being her assistant for my whole education.
Right. And Barb was the department head in book arts. OCAC.
Right.
And OCAC just closed after more than 100 years.
It's so sad. Yeah. It's so sad. I just went to the final closing party and hugged everybody and cried buckets and toured the studios and looked at all the places that I used to work and considered stealing equipment, because why not?
Yeah, that was a great place. A lot of great people came through there, and it will be missed.
I feel like I owe pretty much everything to OCAC, honestly. You know, I would not be where I am today if it weren't for that education. It's been just in terms of skills, and then learning how to piece everything together, mm-hmm. And work through a process in a really lengthy way. Mm-hmm. And then just networking. I mean, the people that I've met and the places that I've gone because of that, I would never have had that. So, and it taught me how to network, you know.
Yeah.
Where to go.
Okay, so you graduated from OCAC, and then what happened next?
I met a man. So a couple things happened simultaneously. I met the man that I'm now married to.
Yeah.
And he lived in Seattle. Okay. And then I also got a job working for, there's a little stationery shop in downtown Seattle called Paper Hammer. Mm-hmm. And I got a job working there. But also I was working for, that same owner also owns an art book publisher called Lucia Marquand. And so I started working for them freelance doing special editions. So I was kind of project managing a lot of work, making books and boxes for things like when a museum releases their catalog for a show, they release also maybe an edition of 100 for their donors and patrons, that kind of thing, or to sell at a higher price point. So I was managing all those things and going back and forth to different studios to do letterpress printing and book binding and box making and projects like that. So that was really fun, and it was what I was trained to do. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was also developing my jewelry line mm-hmm. when I was in my home studio. Because again, I kind of reached the same problem I'd had when I right. left my business, where I wasn't making anything that was creatively mine.
Right.
It really started to take a toll on me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love this. I found this in this article, this quote that you wrote. So I decided one day that what you nourish will thrive, and I quit my jobs and threw myself headfirst into my work.
Yeah.
I think that's
I really believe that. You know, yeah. what you pour your time into is what's going to work for you. And I still have to remind myself of that all the time. And I'm in the process this year again of rethinking and retooling my business. Because mm-hmm. you know, when you're a brand new artist trying to make it, you just say yes, 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 yes to everything. You know, you fall for that exposure line. You know, this is right. good exposure for you. And you do all that stuff. And then at some point you have to start saying no. Mm-hmm. Make the space for the things that you actually want to do. Mm-hmm. But now I'm doing projects that I want to do because I've made the time for them.
Right. Yeah, I remember actually looking at my tax return one year because I was doing teaching and making and something else and trying to see which one made more money. And it turned out they all made the same. So that just told me that I could do anything. So it's a little bit different than what you said there, but that made me think of that when I read that. Yeah. Because it yeah. made me focus and really think about, okay, where do I want to be spending my time?
Yeah. No, I just had a very similar experience where I looked at last year's numbers. Mm-hmm. Or the last few years' numbers, mm-hmm. realized that I can make a choice at this point. So mm-hmm. about 50% of my income comes from art fairs. So I travel around Pacific Northwest mostly. Go to art fairs to sell my jewelry. And that's about half of my income. But the other half is wholesale orders, consignment orders, website orders, custom work a little bit, selling art here and there, that kind of thing. So it kind of made me think the same thing, like which path do I want to follow? Right. You know, yeah. I'm thinking now I'm going to start cutting back on the art fairs. Uh-huh. So I continue to like them because traveling that much, you know, in the summer, I'm out every weekend almost.
Yeah.
You're in a different city.
Right.
And it's very tiring. I mean, in a way, it's like being the touring musician that I thought I would be.
Right.
But it's very tiring and it takes a lot of time away from my studio. And so I'm kind of thinking now that I'll go there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, at this point, you know, I'm very candid about numbers about my business. Uh-huh. So my business brings in about $50,000-$60,000 in art fair income, and also about the same in everything else. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
you know, I kind of want to pick and choose at this point where I go.
Sure.
Yeah. And I feel so lucky to be able to make that decision.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Okay, I want to backtrack a little bit and we'll come back. Describe your jewelry to us, and we'll post pictures mm-hmm. on the webpage, but, and if there was any sort of inspiration to how you started, you have a kind of unique technique and
yeah,
you probably yeah. started with no equipment, but now you have more equipment.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the whole thing started working with you with thinking about paper sculpturally, mm-hmm. you know, and learning how to do that and all the different ways to apply sheets and pulp and, you know, to actual shapes.
Right.
So that started with you, and then also interning with you and making, you know, working on installing sculpture and that kind of thing. It got me thinking about where else you could go with paper. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up at Penland taking a workshop with Melissa J. Craig for a couple of weeks. And it was also a sculptural paper making class. And she taught me even more about you know, dipping into pulp casting. She had some dyeing techniques that I've picked up from her, and that was where I started making jewelry, was in that class with her, partially because I had flown out to Penland, and I was a student and I was kind of out of money, and everyone was shipping their work home to them. And I thought, I need to think small. It's got to go in my suitcase because I'm out of money. I spent my last money on tools and things I liked in the shop.
Right.
I cannot ship things home. But I was taking a ton of metals classes at the time at OCAC. And so I was thinking about jewelry anyway. So I started making these little cocoons that were hanging on earrings and necklaces, and these little sort of shell-looking shapes, and selling them to people who were taking workshops there. I was wearing them around, and then people were wanting to buy them from me.
Uh-huh.
So that's where I started selling them as well.
Uh-huh.
So I came home, and I kind of set that aside for a little bit. But when I started that job in Seattle, those ideas just started flowing again.
Right.
So we had a second bedroom in our tiny little 700-square-foot cottage. So I set it up as my studio, and I put my papermaking outside, and I bought all of my pulp from Mary Ashton, who lives here in Seattle. She was very sad when I bought my beater because I wasn't going to come visit her anymore. So I had this little mini studio, and that's what I've, until a year ago, that's what I've done.
And okay, and what pulp are you using?
All abaca. 100% abaca, way overbeaten, way, way, way overbeaten. Mm-hmm. So I get really translucent sheets.
So, right, but you're not making sheets, right?
Right. No, in fact, I basically have no way to make sheets right now. Uh-huh. I have some of the equipment, and I'm going to have more of it because I actually just got a job making some sheets for a custom piece.
Uh-huh.
But I don't have anything. All of my work is all dipping into pulp, and even I'm making sculpture right now, but it's all again dipped into pulp.
So. Right, and so I'm just curious because so now you have a Mark Lander beater, correct?
Yeah, my little quarter.
So it's a 1 pound.
Yes, it's a 1 pound.
Okay, so that's quite a bit of pulp compared to how the jewelry you're making. So how do you keep the pulp, or I'm curious about your system of.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I keep it for longer than most papermakers do because I actually like it better when it's kind of fermented a bit. And this is something I kind of learned just because for that very reason, I wasn't using enough, you know, and part of the reason I make sculpture now as well is because I'm trying to use up a little more pulp before it goes bad. Cause I have like 10 gallons and I have to do something with it.
Right.
What was I saying?
So you just keep it in buckets in the liquid solution.
Yeah, and I keep it in a cool area. I set it on concrete and I keep it in a cool area. But I actually really like the look of it after it sat there for about a month, and it kind of starts to ferment. I pour a little bleach into it every now and then just to keep the really disgusting mold off of it.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, after it starts to kind of get slightly slimy in a way, the jewelry looks better. It's almost like a formation aid or something. It goes on to the pieces a little smaller because they're so tiny. Because I'm working with pieces that are like, you know, eighth of an inch sometimes, little tiny components.
Yeah. And that makes sense because, it gets slipperier the older it gets, which is frustrating when you're trying to make a sheet of paper.
Yes.
But it serves you well. That's interesting.
And it also breaks down the fiber more. Mm-hmm. You know, beyond the beater, it takes out even more of the clumps.
Mm-hmm.
Because even a teeny tiny clump, I have to pull out. So if it's really broken down, that's what I prefer to use. Mm-hmm. I hate it when I have brand new pulp. I just make sculpture for a while because I'm just waiting for it to get kind of gross. So.
Uh-huh.
My studio doesn't smell great. I have a separate area for like all the smells to happen now. It's contained from the rest, but
right. And your studio is a building outside of your house.
Yeah, we bought a house in Everett, which is just 30 minutes north of Seattle, about a year ago. And I finally have my studio is about 850 square feet now.
Nice.
It's lovely. It's really nice. I have a full wood shop set up now, and then so half of the big space is wood shop and papermaking, and then I have a production studio that I'm sitting in right now.
Okay. And is that where you do metalworking?
Yep. I do all my metal fabrication here.
Okay.
I also have an assistant that does a lot of metal fabrication for me. So I'm doing more finishing now than I used to and less of the metal fabrication, which is really nice.
Right. And what happens in the wood shop?
The wood shop is a new thing. We bought this really old house for one thing.
Uh-huh.
And so we need to fix it up because it's parts of it are falling apart. So we bought all these tools, but I also really want to start adding wood components to my paper sculpture. So I'm doing these kind of vessel forms right now with sculpture, and I really want to start adding turned wooden bases to them and that kind of thing. I'm just starting to think about that, and it's probably going to be a while before I actually start showing anybody any of that work. But it's on its way, and it's in my mind, and it's starting to happen. So,
yeah, yeah. So with the jewelry, tell me a little bit about the, so once you've, don't just tell me about the dipping process and mm-hmm. how long it takes to produce a piece, and then you dye it and you coat mm-hmm. it. And
right, right. So I start with metal fabrication. So I have to have some kind of piece. You know, the pulp can only span a distance of maybe a quarter of an inch, maybe 3/8 of an inch if you're lucky, especially with the really fine pulp that I use. So I fabricate my metal, whatever shape that might be, and then I'm dipping into my pulp anywhere from 3 to 6 or 7 times. So I wanted to go on in really, really thin coats, mm-hmm. A little tiny bit at a time, so it preserves that translucency. Because if it goes on all at once, it clumps and it doesn't look elegant. Uh-huh. So I was going for this glass-like effect where you don't know that it's paper when you first see it.
Right.
You think maybe it's some kind of a resin or a glass or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that goes on, and that's maybe 3 days to a week to get the paper where I'm happy with it.
So you're dipping and letting it dry in between?
Yeah, I have these giant drying racks in my mm-hmm. studio. So I'm hanging out. I have all these tiny, tiny little petals, you know, and little tiny components and rows. So I'm, you know, dipping, 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 and hanging up. That's kind of a big piece of my day is yeah. dipping and dipping and dipping and hanging back up. But every metal component is fabricated with some sort of a little handle on it so that I can work with it for a while.
And what metal are you using?
I use a lot of sterling silver. I use gold filled. I love brass. I use a tiny bit of copper. I like mixing up metals too. Uh-huh. So a lot of my work is multiple right. metal.
Okay.
But yeah, and the gold is new. I'm really loving working with the gold. It's uh-huh. been really nice. Uh-huh. So after all the paper gets cast, then I dye it. And that was something I learned from Melissa J. Craig, was using fiber reactive dye. I use Procyon dye. Mm-hmm. So I can use it cold, and I can get ombre effects with it. Because after the paper's dry, I can paint it on or dip it into the dye, and it travels through the paper and does beautiful things.
Oh yeah.
But I don't use any sort of mordant with it. So at that point, I have to seal in the dye and stabilize the paper with. I use a water-based sealer at that point mm-hmm. to seal it all in. And then after that, it gets a final coat of resin that I thin out with heat and then dip the piece into that. So there's this float of resin on the top okay. to make it solid enough to wear as jewelry.
Right. And I bet people ask all the time.
Yes.
When they find out it's paper. will this last?
Yes, exactly.
And I think I read on your website that you could go swimming with it.
Yes. You can. And actually, I'm thinking I might actually make a little display for my art fair booth this year that has a piece floating inside of a glass jar full of water.
So, oh, that's a good idea.
There's a clear, you know, because yeah, when my jewelry, you know, when I get it dirty or, you know, I'm out gardening my jewelry all the time, I just rinse it off in the sink, mm-hmm. bring it back up.
Right.
Yeah.
And it doesn't react at all to getting wet. Because sometimes paper, when you get it wet, it shrinks and then it expands again back right. to its initial form. But probably because of your coating, that yeah. is eliminated.
And even the water-based sealer that I use is enough to mm-hmm. keep that the water away from it and keep any, you know, shrinkage from happening again.
Right.
But the resin is something I figured out later on uh-huh. as a way to really fully stabilize it.
Right, right. Great idea.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about The Paper Year, a new monthly planner that will be coming out early this fall. I'm rebranding the 12 Months of Paper calendar, which you might be familiar with, a how-to book and calendar featuring a paper project every month. The Paper Year is a wire-bound book still featuring 12 paper projects, and this year, 5 of the projects are designed by guest artists. I can't wait to share them with you. Stay tuned for more info, and there will be information about the upcoming edition of this book at bit.ly/12monthsofpaper, where you'll also find 2019 calendars available at half price.
So let's turn to selling your work. And I read also about one of your grandfathers. You said they were both artists, but, and maybe it was the influence of both, that you just never had the question in your mind that an artist could make a living because you saw it happening around you. And that's so great, because I think it's a huge block for so many people.
Yeah.
And even like their parents are like, oh, you're never going to make it, or, you know, societally, it's just, so that's really cool.
Yeah, no, it's true. Oh, I mean, it was my dad running a cabinet shop and making money that way.
Right.
When I was 15, I went and I stayed with my painter grandfather for a few months to learn painting from him. But he also took it upon himself to show me the numbers of his business and how the business runs.
Right.
So I got to learn exactly where his money comes from and how much comes in and how much goes out and where he invests money to make money. And so by the time I was 15, I thought, well, this is how you do it.
Right.
You know? And I really think that, especially now doing what I'm doing and learning from him, that so he did a lot of reproduction work and calendars and custom things. And I think that a lot of artists are done a disservice by being told that money and art don't go together,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that art for art's sake is why we do it. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to make money, and production art is just as valid as conceptual art. I really believe that. And especially in doing art fairs now and seeing all of these incredible people working in their studios every day, you know, I have as much respect now for someone doing an incredible body care line as I do for someone making paintings. You know, they're doing the same thing every day.
Right.
And it's a beautiful product. And right. If you're doing a good job, you're doing a good job.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so you talked about how people were just buying your earrings, seeing them when you were in school.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just talk a little bit about the ways you sell your work and how that kind of has evolved from that.
Yeah, I just made a website. I had a couple weeks off from work.
Uh-huh.
And I finalized this little tiny line of jewelry that I'd come up with, and I made a website and was lucky enough to get a couple of museum stores right out of the gate, which was really nice. They just found the website and placed orders, and I was off and rolling. So I didn't have to have two jobs for that long.
Right.
So at this point, I used to pitch a lot of stores, and I still occasionally will pitch stores. Mm-hmm. I don't do very much of that anymore because I don't know the exact count right now. I've got about 65, 70 stores that sell my work, mm-hmm. mixed between galleries that represent me, museum stores, clothing stores, all kinds of things all over the country. So that's a big piece of what I do now is my studio filling orders. And then I do sell some off my website too, just to retail customers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do you do the wholesale to stores off your website too, or do you do that over the phone or?
I have a line sheet that's hiding on my website.
Yeah.
So I send people to that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are consignment accounts. And so some of them are very specific about what they want. Others just want me to send them an assortment that keeps rolling. Mm-hmm. So I just do that. Whatever is kind of new and fresh, or whatever colors they're out of, I just keep people stocked, basically.
Right.
And then the wholesale accounts, people tend to order exactly what they want.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm looking to make a wholesale website this year. That's a separate website for the wholesale, because I want to grow that piece of the business more. I really like doing that part. I like working with stores.
Right. And then the other part is interfacing with the public. And you're doing shows mostly in Washington State?
Washington, Oregon.
Oregon.
Yeah, I mostly just stick around. This area is great for arts. Oh, Seattle's amazing for arts.
Right.
Very supportive. People here have some money to spend, and they like to spend it. So that's been good for me.
Yeah. And I imagine, do you get, you must get online retail business through those shows by handing out information.
Yeah. After every show, I go home and I fill orders from people that couldn't decide in person, went to the website and bought things later. So Today, I did a show on Saturday, so today I'll be filling orders from people who couldn't make up their minds from Saturday.
right.
Yeah. But then, you know, a lot of my stores and galleries and things have found me at shows as well. So it's good to get out and show your face and meet people. And because I've met a lot of great people and developed a lot of great relationships with some of my stores that have been really good for me because I've been out at shows.
Sure. Yeah. And is there like a seasonal other lines in the jewelry, like fashion, there must be? Do you adhere to that, or how do you come up with new designs? Do you have a schedule? Because you're so busy. I would imagine you're either just keep making the same thing or you're just pushing new things out there. So tell me a little about that.
I do both of those things. Uh-huh. Yeah. I was pretty adamant when I first started that I did not want to do seasons, did not want to follow the fashion world and do seasons. I did that in a jewelry line that I co-designed before this one. Mm-hmm. And it was just so stressful.
Yeah.
You know, even we did 2 seasons a year. Some jewelry lines do 9 seasons a year.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So I did not want to do that. I was adamant about that. I wanted to develop a line of jewelry that would evolve in the same way that I learned to make art, where mm-hmm. you make something, this is working, so you iterate on that, mm-hmm. and maybe you drop this last piece, and then you iterate here, and then things over time change. So that's the way I've always worked. So I have pieces that I've had from day one because they still sell. I've maybe tweaked them and improved them and as I've gone along.
Uh-huh.
But I have kind of the core line of jewelry that sticks around, and I make that all the time, and it's always available on the line sheet, and it will probably always be. There's a few things I edit out every now and then, but I keep it pretty the same.
Mm-hmm.
And then I add fresh things into it all the time because I'm always kind of thinking and designing new things.
Right.
And then I make one-of-a-kind pieces that I throw out on social media every now and then, or I take to shows with me, and those will sell. And those will give me ideas, too, for how I can make a more, you know, maybe if I've made this giant statement piece and it sells, I think, well, what's the wearable version of that, the small version that I can sell, you know, 100 of?
Right.
So I kind of have to do it all. And that's partially for my own sanity, too. I mean, if I just did production all day, I think I would kind of lose the ball.
Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah.
I do like production, though. I'm a very happy production worker, so that helps. You know, I like, you know, going to my studio and putting on my audiobooks and, you know, making the same earring all day. I really actually like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I love listening to audiobooks or podcasts in my studio, too.
Mm-hmm.
So at what point did you decide to hire an assistant, and how many hours a week does she work?
Yeah, I've gone through a few assistants at this point. I think I'm on my fourth or fifth. I have to go back and count how many have worked for me. And at some points I've had 2. Right now I have kind of 1.5. Okay. She works for me. I think she's somewhere about 15 to 20 hours a week right now. She works for me, and she's all piecework. And I made that decision early on too, that I never wanted someone to work in my studio with me, because that really tramples on my game and what I'm doing here. And I need a lot of alone time in the studio to be able to come up with new things for the line.
Right.
There's too many people in and out of here. I can't settle down enough to make work. And I would never make art ever.
Right.
I need to be here on my own with all of my resources around me. But I started hiring assistants really quickly because things started to grow too fast for me to be able to keep up with them.
Right. That makes sense. And then, I'm just curious about like how many of a piece you make, or just kind of your production schedule. Are you basing it on orders? Or are you kind of have a sense of, oh, I'll probably sell these, or a little of both?
You know, it's always been a guessing game. It still is. I mean, I have pieces that, you know, I'm getting better at it. Like I'm right now, springtime's a little slower, but summer's ramping up now.
Mm-hmm.
So I have time to build a little inventory. So this spring I knew a little better than last spring what to make more of.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that I have some basics that are always going to sell. So I'll have, you know, 50 or 100 of something sitting waiting because I know it's going to sell over the course of a season.
Yeah.
Other things, I've made a lot of something and then it's still sitting there.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I thought I initially made it and I loved it. And I thought everyone else would love it the way I love it. didn't happen. You know, other times I'm just messing around in the studio. I have this pair of earrings that I was getting ready for a show, and I thought, oh, I don't have many hoop earrings, but I have these little components that go on other pieces that I'm going to cast paper onto, but they're not done. I'm just going to put little ear wires on these and take them just to fill out this one display. That's not my best selling earring. Right. So you never know. You have to just kind of roll with it.
Yeah. That's so funny.
So I do my best, and I'm trying to actively learn all the time what's going to work and not work. But I mean,
yeah. Well, it makes it exciting.
Yeah. Just stay humble.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Is there a special custom piece or project that you've worked on for a customer you want to tell me about?
I've had some good ones. I was thinking about this earlier. I've had some great projects I wish I could tell you about that I've had to sign non-disclosure agreements about. Uh-huh. You know, but that's part of how that works. Some of your best projects you'll never be able to talk about. I have one right now that I'm just starting to work on. Uh-huh. It's amazing, and I wish I could talk about it, but I can't. But I did, one of the coolest things I did was, I was doing a jewelry sale, the Bainbridge Art Museum, which is wonderful for book arts, by the way. Mm-hmm. They once or twice a year, they'll close down the bottom floor of their museum and do a big sale, a kind of mini art fair down there. Mm-hmm. And they did a jewelry themed one year. And I sold my jewelry over the weekend at the art museum. And I met, who happens to live there, Leatrice Eisman, who's the executive director of Pantone.
Oh.
She happens to live on Bainbridge Island.
Okay.
And she came to my booth, and she pointed at this. I had this big neck piece with all these leaves kind of cascading across it, kind of ombre leaves going across the front. And she pointed at it, and she said, "Is that the Pantone color of the year?" I didn't know who this was at the time.
Right.
And I said, "Oh, you know what? I think it might be, but by accident, because I started that color a couple years ago, and I love it. It was the year the color was called Greenery."
Uh-huh.
And she said, "Well, you know, I decided that color this year." And so she commissioned me to customize that piece and make her some other things. And she wore that big neck piece for her European lecture tour for about the Greenery, the Pantone color of the year. So that was really cool. So I got to see on her blog all these images of her wearing this big neck piece for all of her talks.
Wow.
Is it cool?
That is really cool. Yeah. Right. And are you still doing any book arts?
Well, I mean, what I always say is yes, because I make paper every day.
Right. There you go.
Paper making is one of those things. It's like, are you a fibers artist or are you a book artist?
Right.
You know, that's such an interesting intersection.
Mm-hmm.
But I am working on a project right now that is a book arts project. Mm-hmm. The one I can't talk about.
Right.
And I occasionally do go back in and play with things, but mostly no. Mostly my book arts things are stashed away because this has been a big focus. And really what I want to do now is make sculptural work when I am with paper,
mm-hmm.
when I am making things. I worked in book arts when I moved here for a long time, and then I taught bookbinding for quite a long time too. I was doing a lot of teaching, and at some point, I don't know, I just needed a break.
Yeah.
I think also having done it, you know, been in books and doing book restoration before that as well, this feels right now.
Yeah.
You know, to become where I have, but we'll see.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think I've seen on Instagram images of this piece that's behind you. Maybe we can get a picture of you after we stop talking.
Yeah, sure.
It's a more sculptural piece. So is that one of the directions you're going in?
Yeah. I'm looking at, I look at a lot of ancient jewelry, and then by proxy looking at a lot of ancient vessels.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been making vessel shapes, and this one is actually kind of a Native American basket inspired. The whole thing is woven kind of basket wire and reed,
uh-huh.
In kind of a Native American sort of inspired shape. Mm-hmm. This piece is going to have lots and lots of my tiny little quarter inch petals that I add to a lot of my jewelry. It's going to have vines of those, black vines of those going all over it by the time I'm done with it.
So you, but you scaled up a form, a vessel form.
Yeah.
So this is maybe 18 inches in diameter.
Yeah, this one's pretty. This one's pretty big.
And you're dipping that like
a big vessel back there. That I'm dipping into for that one. A little heavier pulp. This is again like the pulp that hasn't fermented enough, and I'm not happy with it. You know, for the sculpture, it's great. So that's what I'm working on while the pulp gets better. Using the old pulp for the jewelry right now. But I'm also working on some wall pieces. I'm making some big abaca flowers. Mm-hmm. That I'm painting with kakushibu, and then attaching to big branches that are going to hang on the wall. So that's also in the studio right now. That's happening, and I'm liking the direction that's going. And I think I'm going to be adding in some precious stones and that kind of thing to them as well. So there's a little connection back to my jewelry.
And let's just say that kakushibu is fermented persimmon juice. Mm-hmm. It's got a dark brown, reddish color. And it's also waterproof. So why did you choose that over the fiber reactive dyes that you use in your jewelry? Just curious.
I want to try something different.
Yeah.
You know, I think part of the vessels too is coming from, I'm looking at a little more Korean paper making right now, and just, you know, the traditional Korean paper chamber pot has just stuck in my mind for years. So I think I'm iterating on that a little bit. But I've always wanted to try kakushibu and never had. So I finally managed. It's a little hard to get your hands on, apparently. I finally managed to order some. And I just love the color. Uh-huh. And I love the lacquer look that it gives. Mm-hmm. So it's an iteration kind of on my jewelry. What I've been interested in is like adding an extra layer of texture to the paper. It's kind of the same sort of thing.
Yeah. And if, in case anybody's interested, because you mentioned it's hard to find, where did you find it, if you're willing to share?
I remember the name of a website. I ordered it. It was from, I'd have to send you the link later.
Okay.
Of the website. It was somewhere.
I think Hiromi Paper probably carries it.
I think I tried to buy it from Hiromi Paper, and they were sold out of it for a long time. But they might have it again.
Okay. Okay, cool. And so it's summer now. So are you going to be doing art fairs all summer?
Yes. I've already started. Yeah. Uh-huh. Spring is quieter. I don't do many art fairs. Mm-hmm. In fact, I did the, there's a big Northwest Flower and Garden show at the convention center in downtown Seattle. So I did that in February. And then I just said no for a few months, just so I could stock up on inventory and fill up my stores and my galleries with work and design new work and make art and kind of relax a little bit and garden, kind of thing. But the art fairs schedule has started up again. I already did one last weekend. I've got two more coming up next week.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll do, right now I'm doing maybe 30 to 40 art fairs a year.
Wow.
Yeah. So that starts pretty heavy in summer, especially July, August are really busy through September and October. And then October, November, I take a restock break. Yeah. And then I start really heavily again.
For the holidays.
For the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So.
Well, I wanted to ask you about packaging. Do you have interesting packaging? I've never seen your packaging.
I do, actually.
Yeah.
I bought a little, for my Taz, I bought a little plotter cutter. You know, the little home plotter cutters you can get.
Okay.
Stick a piece of paper to a sticky mat, and you lay out a vector file on your computer, and it cuts out these little images. So all of my tags are my little Verso logo cut out, and then folded over, so it's kind of a shadowy effect.
Oh.
Book art's all the way, right? Like I've tried to outsource my labels a couple of times and my tags, and no one does a good job. They don't look right.
Too bad. You would think with all the technology today, it could happen, but.
I know, but it's, I don't know, maybe I'm too type A. I just need to control over all the aspects. But you know, presentation is huge for me.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time, like, fussing over my booth and how things look and what color a piece is sitting on and all of that.
Yeah, and your booths look beautiful in the pictures that I see. Yeah, we'll have to post an image of one of those too, of one of your shows. Yeah, and your company name. I'm sorry, we didn't even mention that yet, but Verso.
Yeah.
Tell me where that name comes from.
Yeah, well, so bookbinding, printmaking, papermaking terms. So the Verso is the reverse side of the sheet of paper, the underside of the piece of paper. And then I was thinking about ways to talk about something being paper, but what's the secret side of that? You know, because you don't know my jewelry's paper right away. So what's the secret side of paper? And that's the Verso. That's the underside that you don't see.
There you go.
But then I also learned. I've learned it's a word in a lot of languages. I've mm-hmm. learned sometimes that, you know, in Spanish, it's the verse of a poem or a song. And I actually had a Finnish lady come into my booth and ask if it was the Finnish word. And she told me that it meant either a seedling, like a new sprout, mm-hmm. or a new beginning in life.
Right.
I burst into tears. Like, that's so perfect.
That's so perfect. Yeah. Oh, just came through you. Yeah, wonderful. Wow. So where can we see your work online, Melanie?
So my website is versojewelry.com, VersoJewelry.com. And then my Instagram, I post lots of process photos and that kind of thing. I'm very sharing with how I do everything. Mm-hmm. So that's Verso Studio. And then on Facebook, I also post there, and that's Verso Studio Seattle.
Okay, well, it's been super fun talking to you. And I know listeners are going to love looking at your work in addition to hearing this podcast. So thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much, Helen. This was so much fun.
Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.
The reason, besides the season, the main contender.